Thank you. Hi, everybody. My name is Fred. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. I'm going to start out with an idea, and then I'm going to tell you what happened to me. So the idea is this. We talk a lot in the meetings about sharing the message of the 12-step program of Overeaters Anonymous. That appears in all the literature. It appears in the steps. What is the message? What is the message? Whatever the past is, your past, my past, whatever it was, does it determine with certainty the future? This is a moment when all of you and I are all sitting here in front of our computers, sharing whatever it is that we're sharing. Seconds are ticking by. This second, right now, are you ready to be free? Free. That's what it says in all that literature we read. Whatever the wreckage of the past, you may determine at any moment, and this moment doesn't end here. There'll be another one tomorrow and another one the day after that. You may determine that you are ready to be free of all the misery that most of us have known from compulsive eating, compulsive thoughts, compulsive food behaviors, all this stuff. We're not, in my experience, guilty of it. It's not our fault that we have this disorder. It's not our fault. But unfortunately, it's our responsibility to do anything about it because only we can. So my name is Fred again. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater. This is my 29th year in the program. I'm 15 years abstinent from sugar. And let me tell you what happened to me. So I'm 65. I'll be 65 next month. When I came in the program, I was 36 or something. I don't know. I was younger than I am today. Before I came in the program, I was over 400 pounds. And I was a little confused about how I had gotten there. Because it's true that I like to eat. I was never a gourmet, but I certainly enjoyed eating. But everybody I knew liked to eat. Everybody liked the same things that I love. Well, not everybody, but everybody likes ice cream and Chinese food and pizza and Doritos and all that stuff. And yet I had so many friends that liked all the same things I did, and yet they weren't 400 pounds. I didn't understand why I was 400 pounds. And what I realized ultimately was, even though a lot of people like all those things, they had other things in life. Other areas of their lives, other things to engage in life that they found gratifying. But because of who I was, because my body was the way it was and my mind was the way it was, I had so many fewer avenues that made life really worth living for me. And I didn't know this innately. This took some kind of thinking about it, some painful examination of my own life. So, what was it like before? Well, I ate kind of normally during the day. By that, I mean not too extraordinarily. You know, I ate pretty much three meals and didn't limit the meals, but I didn't eat what I regarded as gargantuan portions of things. I didn't binge based on what I thought binging was. But from the time night fell, or from the time dinner was over, and I tend to have very late hours. I like to get up late, and when I'm not working, I get up late and go to sleep late. So I viewed the daytime as belonging to my responsibilities to other people and the nighttime as belonging to me. And therefore, the night hours from dinner on, which in my case was maybe from 8 or 9 o'clock until maybe 3 in the morning or 4, I stay up late, was pretty much an uninterrupted graze of one thing and another. And I lived for much of my life in New York City, where if you're of a mind to find things to eat, you can get them pretty much any hour of the day. Now, what's interesting is when you're addicted to something, I found, your life is in a sense very small. It's very reduced. You know, you have only two states. The state is, I'm not okay. I don't feel okay in the world. And I better get something to make me feel okay. Or I would return from Food Emporium, our local supermarket, with a couple of bags full of the various things that I like to eat. And for that day, for that weekend, life was okay. Life was had enough things in it to make it bearable and even pleasurable at times, that my problems, whatever they were, didn't matter. They were eradicated by the full pleasurable experience of eating. That was as deep as it got with me. I had a doctor that I went to, and I chose a doctor that smoked. You know, I was looking for a doctor that wasn't going to give me a lot of shit about how fat I was. So I chose a doctor that smoked, but he was a very nice, good doctor. And he said to me, when I wasn't even 40 yet, I was a pretty young guy, and he said, you know, you're getting to the age where people start to get picked off by the things you have. I had high blood pressure from the time that I was 21. I had a blood clotting disorder, some other stuff wrong with me. Now, he scared me. You might think that scaring, getting a real scare at such a young age would make you refrain. With me, it had the opposite effect. I said, you know, I can't do anything about this. This is the way I am. Fuck it. Let's have a party. You know, life's too short for me to, I don't care. I can't do anything about it. So I began to really eat as much as I want of whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted it. And in fact, what I didn't realize was that attitude didn't apply just to my eating, but to almost everything in my life. I was smart enough, resourceful enough, lucky enough that I had a lot of control over my life, or so I thought, and I would only engage in activities that I thought were guaranteed to make me feel good. As a result, my life became a tiny little shoebox, because I wouldn't subject myself to the cold rain of other people's judgment. I wouldn't try dating girls in the normal sense, because what kind of a nutty girl is gonna wanna tie her future up with somebody, I don't know, who's 400 pounds, but is such a big broken-hearted baby like me? And I would only work in a very limited way because I was ashamed of how I looked, and I didn't wanna, again, I'm an actor, and being an actor, you know, you're constantly judged and constantly rejected and all that. And I became a kind of a star in this little teeny world of voiceovers. And then in those days, it was a much smaller world. And so I didn't have to show my face, but I was lucky, I made a lot of money doing that. So I could indulge all these kind of habits. What I didn't understand was that there's a difference. Now, some of you have heard me speak before, and I know I harp on this a lot, but in my life, it was a great big discovery. I didn't understand that there's a real difference between comfort and happiness. Comfort and happiness are two different things. But because I had this deeply held belief that real happiness was so fraught with risk, with danger, with rejection, with pain, I wasn't willing to actually do the things that my heart wanted. What do I mean by that? I wanted to have a partner in life who was a real partner, not a sexual and romantic relationship built on a difference of power, but built on more of partnership, more equality. But I thought, I'm too fucked up. I'm too much of a reject in some way. This is what I thought. I want to have work that uses all of me, and I feel like I'm contributing something important with it. But instead, I settled for a very narrow kind of work where I was saying, you know, see the USA on your Chevrolet, essentially, and making a lot of money for it, but it was only satisfying in the money. I wanted to subject myself to things like traveling, but I had a huge fear about airplane travel. I wanted to take care of myself, but I had a fear of dentists, a fear of doctors, a fear of all kinds of things. And my life became this tiny little shoebox thing. I thought if all of life is just what I want, if all to be vulgar about it, if all of life is ring-dings and blowjobs, it'll be great. Except it wasn't. It was a prison. It was a prison that made me more and more think that I'm all I can do is what I can do to feel better. My life became about making myself feel better. The amassment of comfort. Thank you. So that's what I tried to do in everything, amass comfort. And of course, I got fatter and more miserable. I had some friends that had been in OA, and I had a girlfriend. We broke up, and I thought, well, Jesus, I got to do something. So February 1st, 1993, I had briefly tried OA in 1980 when I was in grad school, and I was not ready for it. But in 1993, February 1st, I was really frightened and really desperate. And I had a friend that was an alcoholic, a young guy, who had recovered through AA. So I tried to go to an OA meeting. And I chose meetings at this place called Moravian in New York City because they had late night meetings. And I didn't want to eat late at night. So they had these meetings that went to like 10 o'clock every night. So I started going to these meetings. And I really liked it because there was a purity to it. There was nobody making any money. There was nobody becoming a grand poobah. It was just people helping each other in this noble idea of trying to get well, trying to get better. And I met some people, and I met this particular guy through these people who took people through the steps. And by the way, let me say about this step thing that I don't have any, I mean, this is a way that I was taken through, but any way that you do wholeheartedly works. The thing is, it has to be wholehearted. But this guy took people through the first seven steps in two nights. I say this sometimes to people and their jaws drop. There's a book called Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. It's AA approved literature. And it describes how they used to do it in the early days of AA in Akron, Ohio, one of the two big groups in America at that time in the 30s. Anyway, I was taken through the first seven steps in two nights. One of the things that I had to agree to, and this also sometimes shocks people, is one of the things that I agreed to is that I would never, for the rest of my life, ever do the steps again, ever, in any other program, for any other reason, ever. Promised that. Had to do that as a condition of doing it. Why? Why do you imagine? Because if it wasn't my last chance, I would not do it with the wholeheartedness necessary for it to work. I agreed to that, and I still agree to it to this day, 29 years later. Well, what happened? I was presented with this idea, the idea that I must find a higher power or a God of my own heart and mind. Meaning, if there was a problem with Judaism or Christianity or Buddhism, as I understood them at the time, don't worry about them. Find your own idea, just like Abby Thatcher had said to Bill in the Big Book that we read all the time. Find your own idea. That was hard, because what I had to do was, how do I explain the fact that there's Nazis? How do I explain the fact that my children have autism? How do I explain the fact that the people die of cancer? All these horrible things go on in the world that I don't understand. I don't understand why they happen. They seem unjust. They seem unfair. The world seems cruel. What I was told is I had to find a God of some kind in my own heart, not out there in the cosmos, but in my own heart, in spite of the fact that there's much about life that I don't understand and that seems unfair. And what I was told was if I asked that thing for help in earnest, it didn't matter whether or not I believed in it. The crucial part was to ask for help. I did. And the guy taking me through the steps said one other thing that was very crucial. He said, you said that you believe that there's something that's eternal, some kind of thing that's eternal. Instead of just praying to that thing or delivering that thing up your list of things that you would like, He said, open the channel the other way. In other words, say to that thing, okay, what is it that you want of me? Not what do I want from you? What do you, God, higher power, want of me? And the answer came back. It didn't take long. And what was it? Well, it wasn't too complicated. The answer was, be willing to face your fears and not be bullied by them into having a smaller life, and try and be a better man, meaning try not to be so selfish. That was all I got. But that revolutionized my entire life, honestly.
Five
left, thank you. You know, eating for me had been this kind of intimate experience. I didn't do it in front of other people. I mean, I ate in front of other people, but I didn't really eat. I can remember in my 30s, a lot of my friends were getting married and I would go to these weddings and, you know, it was very nice. They're all people I loved and stuff. And I remember sitting there at these weddings thinking, this is so nice. All these guys that I love and I went to college with, but I just wish they would get the fuck out of here so I could be alone with these pastries. That would be very nice. Of course, they didn't listen. And I only thought it, I didn't say it. But the thing that I needed to do, not only was it a little bit shameful, but it was so, you know, visceral, intimate. I couldn't do it in front of other people. What the steps did to me was made me say to myself, don't accept the booby prize. There's nothing wrong with food, but for me, it's a booby prize. It's not what my heart really wants. Try and have the courage to endure the uncertainty, live in the big world with all that can happen wrong. Not this little fake world that I created, but the big world with all that we don't know the answers about, and see what happens. Roll the dice, but be willing to live that way. You know, courage doesn't mean you don't feel afraid. It means you're willing to accept a certain amount of fear and not let it bully you into having a tiny little life. You know, I wanted food because my life was not sweet. I wanted to have something sweet to hold on to. People that have other problems with food, where they try and control all of reality by controlling the shape of their thighs, the shape of their body. We all want the same thing, which is to eliminate feelings in life that are unpleasant, painful, and there's plenty of them. The whole point of finding a God of your own heart and mind is to get out of this enduring pain where all you can do is think of escaping from the pain. When you're in pain, you know, you can't think about anything else but being out of pain. So the idea was, first of all, to get out of this unrelenting pain, and then to really have some freedom about how it was that I was to live my life. That's exactly what happened. So I could talk about food. I find food talk generally boring, but I'm happy to do it. I haven't eaten any sugar for 15 years. I don't eat flour. I don't eat starchy vegetables like potatoes, rice, things like that. I have 3 meals and 2 snacks a day. I'm not required to have the snacks, but if I want to have them, I'm not required, but I always do have them. I've lost 170 something pounds. I'm not exactly sure. I recently changed my eating plan in the last year and a half. My son went on this sort of low carb thing. I did it with him. I'm staying on it, not extreme, but I don't, it's not like keto, but I just don't eat bread and stuff like that. I eat plenty of vegetables and fruit and stuff. I've lost another almost 45 pounds since doing that. So here I am, I'm 65 years old. I'm in better shape today at 65. I have more women interested in me. I have more work. I have more everything good in life than I had when I was 35, honest. And my life is full of trouble. I have a zillion troubles. I have physical problems, which I won't bore you with, but plenty of serious physical problems. I have 2 children with autism, one of whom is doing great, the other one's not doing as great. I'm in the middle of getting separated from my wife after 27 years of being together. I got a zillion problems, but it doesn't matter because my life every day is so good. I have so much joy in my life and real satisfaction. And I think in my case, it's because I had to be willing to give up having this tiny controlled life, including compulsive overeating, for having some discomfort And yet that opening up the possibilities of life, which really is beautiful. And, you know, the way life works is, if your head is in a bad place, it doesn't matter what good happens to you. You know, it does. You can be making lots of money and have a great job and everything else. And if you feel lousy, you feel lousy. And the converse is also true. You can be at the end of your rope, and then a sunny day happens, and you're walking along, and you see a pretty person smiles at you, and you remember a great movie, and you, I don't know, life is beautiful. It's all subjective. It's all how you feel. But the problem is that you can't control how you feel. You have to control what you do. So my life now is based not on how I feel, but on what I do. I try and do good for myself and for other people. But that had a huge effect on the trajectory of my life. And it's allowed me to get better and help many other people begin to get better in their lives. And that is what this shit is about. And it's so good. I never get tired of OA. With all the bullshit that you hear about my family and my mess and my boyfriend, and blah, 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 I never get tired of it because it's beautiful. It's people making their lives better, which is, to me, the noblest and most beautiful thing I've ever known. And I thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Fred. That's wonderful. We're going to open up the time now.